Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this month's FIA webinar. It's great here in Boston. It's the end of August. The weather is perfect. And I'm your host, Adam Russo, the CEO of the FIA Group. With me, as always, is our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
In addition, as always, we have John Jablon, our legal counsel. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And we have a special guest today. Arriving last night on a flight from Cleveland is one of our attorneys who works in our Cleveland, Ohio office. And her name is Kelly Dempsey. Say hello, Kelly.
Hello.
You're supposed to say hello, Kelly.
That's easy all to say,
but that's all right. Nice try. So, guys, today we have a jam-packed hour. We're going to fly through this. We have a bunch of slides to go through. As always, feel free to email us. You can text us there. Any questions? If we have any question time, we will read them. We actually look at those during the sessions to see if there's anything pertinent as it relates to that particular slide. Today's presentation is on unwrapping your wraps. So, yes, we're talking about wrap networks. We're going to dissect them. We're going to talk about wrap networks in detail, what they say, what the contracts say, what they don't say, what you can and cannot do, and some of the successes we have seen from across the country just with various TPAs and brokers and self-funded employers, wherever they may be. So with that, let's get this started. So the first thing I want to make sure is everyone knows, feel free to email us, as always, at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. What we do every single month is, based on the type of emails, and we get hundreds of them every single month, we will make sure to talk to you very shortly about what the most popular topics are. You can basically ask us anything at all about anything, whether it's ACA compliance, stop-loss issues, network issues, whatever it may be. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our rookie here, Kelly Dempsey, to talk about what the most frequently asked questions were in the month of July that were sent over to PGC Referral. Take it over, Kelly.
All right, so the first one was about mental health parity and residential treatment coverage requirements. We were getting this question a lot as the ACA and mental health parity has been a significant focus of the DOL. So as we all know, the ACA doesn't generally require self-funded plans to cover specific benefits. Mental health parity also has that same caveat. They don't require you to cover mental health benefits. If you cover mental health benefits, they must do so in parity with the medical surgical benefits. So this is basically an action item for plans. You need to look at how your benefits are classified under the six classifications under the Mental Health Parity and Equity Addiction Act to determine whether or not you're in compliance with it. So obviously, if you have any questions, feel free to email us so we can further discuss and determine if your plan has any red flags. Second question is about HIPAA concerns and whether or not the employer versus the plan sponsor versus the plan administrator role and whether or not prescription drug costs are obviously a huge issue. Employers are very, very frazzled with the cost of RX drugs these days. And, you know, as a self-funded plan, you have more access to data. But just because you have access to that data doesn't mean you're using your data in a permissible way. You can't really use it to police employees. So specifically with respect to HIPAA, you need to keep your role separate, the employer versus the plan sponsor versus the plan administrator. Be careful how you're using those. So, for example, you shouldn't use your PBM data to look at what employees are using and how they're using their drugs to determine if they're using prescription drugs in an illegal manner. And I'll circle back around to the other mental health parity question. This ties right into our FIA Unwrapped. We're getting some mental health parity questions about negotiating mental health and substance use claims, and we can equate these to dialysis carve-outs. There's no problem with paying these claims and negotiating these claims as long as they're in parity with the benefits. So when I say parity, we're looking at co-insurance levels, co-payments, things like that. Are the benefits in parity with the medical surgical benefits? It's not going to how the payment is determined. So obviously you have your network agreements, which will say what the network claims are going to be paid. So if you're paying your out-of-network claims using reference-based pricing, there's not an issue. So that's something that we can definitely talk about further. And if you have questions about using FIA Unwrapped specifically to help control those claims, you know where to get us. And then last but not least, preventive care requirements and generic drugs. This is another stemming off of the prescription drug situation. Another situation where we're getting a lot of questions and what plans are required to do. We see a lot of plans that are implementing cost control items and trying to cover only generics. And the regulations and guidance have said this is generally permissible unless a specific provider for a person comes and says that it's medically inappropriate for that person to receive that prescription drug in a generic form. So there are situations where the plan may have to write in specific language that says that if it's only covering generics, what situations it will cover other benefits. And obviously, if you have questions, we can certainly further assist with that.
So to give you an example, we received 17 questions related to the mental health parity coverage and requirements, 9 HIPAA ones, and 6 related to the preventive care requirements. So even though you may think you're the only person asking about it, a bunch of people have been asking the same questions, particularly what we noticed the hot topic right now is mental health parity. So really quick, want to bring up a quick contest we're doing. You may or may not have noticed, but the FIA group since August 1st has had a very different approach to our social media. We're really getting involved on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. So we're doing a special LinkedIn and Twitter contest. Feel free, obviously you attended our webinar, visit our LinkedIn or Twitter page, and if you can post or tweet, it says honest feedback. I guess I want to just say good feedback, right? Positive feedback?
Constructive feedback.
But good. Constructive but good. Anything you want to say about our webinar, even if you want to send us topics or things we should discuss in the future, we put down with the tag there at the FIA group, and we will do a raffle and a person that says maybe win. It is, they actually win. We will give out next month, at next month's webinar, we will advise you who you are for this month's winner. We will give 1 hour of free consultative guidance and services to the winner. So good luck to all of you, and please check us out on LinkedIn and Twitter, and make us one of your favorites. So what are we going to cover really quickly? Form 5500 updates. This is huge. Kelly's going to talk about this. A lot of people have been asking about it. What's wrong with the networks? What you could do without a network claims? We're going to talk about wraps, network modifiers, FIA unwrapped, which ties right back into our discussion on wrap networks, carve-outs, what we've been seeing, and last but not least, general best practices in the self-funded world. Now, remember, most of the stuff we're talking about, if you are working with a carrier or a national, let's say a fully insured business, forget it. ASO business, chances are, many of the stuff we're talking about, you will not be able to do. So before you start trying these things, please either consult us or have somebody review your administrative service agreement to see what you can and cannot do. And with that, we'll turn it back over to Kelly. Kelly?
All right, so if you haven't heard yet, the Form 5500 updated rules for the proposed rules were issued on July 21st. The biggest impact that probably hits the self-funded industry is the small unfunded plan were previously exempt from the 5500 filing, and unfortunately that exemption under these proposed rules will be eliminated. So that's by far probably one of the biggest ways that this is impacting our industry, is that if you previously thought you had an exemption, you may be kissing that goodbye. Along with that, and the main reason behind the rules is that they are modifying some of the schedules that will be associated with the 5500 filing, and some of these are to essentially update the 5500 to match what the DOL looks for with compliance. So they're updating the schedules to match the ACA reporting requirements and things like that. So it's for more data gathering and to gather the more current data to ensure compliance with all the new regulations that are obviously being rolled out. There is a EBSA webinar that the DOL is putting on tomorrow. It's at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. They put these on, they're free. So if you have time and want to listen to that, you can register on their website. If you can't find the link, they did actually just update their website completely yesterday. So they moved some things around and they're in different locations. So if you can't find the link to register, let us know. We'll give you the link to register for that webinar. Comments are due for this on October 4th. So obviously if you're feeling passionate about these proposed rules and how they're going to impact you and your clients, submit comments and just make sure you have them in before that they are due.
All right. This is Ron. I'm looking forward to now talking a little bit about networks. I want to start with a disclaimer. When we talk about networks, it's important to understand that we are not indicating that this is true for every single network out there, nor are we necessarily saying that everybody has an issue with their network. What we have done is identify those outliers or those issues that have been brought to our attention. Those, the good, bad, ugly, the ugliest of the ugly issues that we are aware of from our consulting work. Things that you need to keep an eye on, and unfortunately, things that tend to be more common with certain types of networks versus others. As you are looking at your own relationship, or if you would like, we can assist you in analyzing your relationship, your contracts, how things are processed in an in-network versus out-of-network procedure. We can help you determine if these issues are present for you. And as we delve a little bit deeper into it, John is actually going to talk about some specific language out of contracts that we've seen and the sort of the pros and cons of that language and how it can negatively impact you. But starting at that 30,000-foot level, I just want to talk about networks in general. RAPs, PPOs, it doesn't matter. The issue that people are bringing to our attention when it comes to a network relationship is that there's too much emphasis on discounts, all right? And I'm not telling you anything you haven't already heard, either in our webinars or at any industry event. A discount in and of itself in a vacuum is a beautiful thing. Who doesn't want a discount, right? You know, you see the flyer for a sale at your favorite store, of course you're going to head over there and spend your hard earnings because why not, right? Everybody loves a discount. The problem is a discount is only as good as the price against which the discount is being applied. And if there's no control or ceiling on how much can be charged, then that discount loses its meaning. Because if I can inflate my rate at an equal or greater amount than the discount is worth, it basically nullifies the discount. So an overemphasis on discounts is voided by arbitrary or inflated bill charges. Is that the network's fault? No. You know, that's something that the provider is doing, and frankly, it's something that the industry supports from the provider level. That's just the way provider pricing is done. Unfortunately, again, it, to a certain degree, invalidates the value of discounts. Add to that unequal bargaining power, right? Again, when you're talking about a network or the value within the network, you or your client may have certain requests of that network. You know, we would really like these providers to be in network. We would really like these level discounts. We would really like some sort of a limit on how much is going to be charged. You've got all these demands, but what's your bargaining power? You know, things like steerage, prompt payment, electronic payment, client liaison, specifically someone who's designated a concierge for that provider. There are certain things that larger clients have that maybe a smaller group cannot offer. You need to have some sort of a structure in place that if you don't have that kind of weight behind your word, then you can still get something of value. Also, there's the insurance company mentality. You know, a lot of this has to do with providers. I was actually recently in a waiting room at a clinic, which is in a hospital, and I overheard, you know, hopefully this is not a HIPAA violation, right, but I overheard some of the billing professionals talking about this ID card that a patient had given them, and I can't use names, but I overheard it was actually the name of a TPA that's relatively large and someone I'm familiar with. And they started saying, which carrier is this? Which network is this? I don't recognize this network. Is that United? Is that Blue Cross? I don't know what it is. They had no idea how to deal with it because, again, this line between a network and an insurance carrier has been blurred to the point that the two are one. And there's this attitude that if you have a network, you're an insurance carrier, and it's all one pot, one pool of money. And if, frankly, we overcharge you in one area, if we undercharge you elsewhere, it's all going to balance out and be fine. It's not so specifically when you're talking about self-funding, various plans, all unrelated to each other, despite that the fact that they're tapping into the same network through the same administrator. And then last but not least, the issue of loyalty. You know, if I have someone who's looking to advocate for me at a bargaining table, you know, I don't want them to also be advocating for the one with whom I'm bargaining, right? That's sort of an impartial mediator versus a zealous advocate on my part, which I think a lot of people who enter into these network arrangements think that the sole purpose of this network is to go in and get them the best deal they can and strong-arm the providers. So, yes, there are pros and cons to network usage. We're not going to get into that right now. I could spend just as much time talking about all the wonderful things you get from networks. I'm not here to bash the networks. What I am here is to tell you that within the realm of issues, things that you need to be watching for when working with a network structure, RAB networks emphasize those issues, sort of maximize the negative and minimize the positive where those issues are concerned.
So one of the things I wanted to bring up here is we get why people have networks. We have one here at the Fee Group for our self-funded plan. We have that nice national network with their nice logo on all the ID cards. It makes people feel safe. It makes them feel secure. The reality of the situation is 9 out of 10 employers would not feel comfortable based on a recent survey that we have done internally would not feel comfortable leaving that safety of a network. They like it. What, for all the good and for the bad, they like it. Their employees like it. That's why they offer benefits in the first place. Believe it or not, before healthcare reform, there were employers that even though they weren't required to offer healthcare coverage to their employees, they still did. About 60% of them. So at the end of the day, what you have to realize is while there is only so much you could do with networks, there is no member loyalty to a wrap network. No member looks at a wrap network logo and says, yes, I got that network. That's what I wanted. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
When they go some other part of the country, they could care less. We want to make sure we spend the 40 minutes we have remaining about what you can do on the out-of-network claims. As Bernie Sanders would like to say, the one percenters.
Yeah.
What is the one percenters do? What are the one percenters doing? These examples we're going to share are going to talk about what you can do in regards to your wrap claims that is different and better than what you're currently doing today. So, Ron, what's wrong with them right now?
Yeah, I mean, Adam, you nailed it. It's the fear of out-of-network claims. That's what drives all of this. And your decision to use a wrap network is because you are so afraid of out-of-network claims. Why are you afraid of out-of-network claims? Because when there are out-of-network claims, you're applying old-fashioned, usual customary language. Your patients are being balance-billed. It's a nightmare. And so your decision to avoid that type of out-of-network scenario, are you going to revise and refresh how you treat out-of-network claims? Are you going to implement a program that actually makes out-of-network claims not so bad? No. You're going to avoid them entirely by layering what could be a very valuable PPO network with this wrap network safety net. The problem is the discounts make the standard network discounts look like freebies. It almost looks like you're not paying anything in comparison. You know, I look at a discount like 40, 50%, and I think to myself, man, I could do better than that. Well, how about 5 or 10%, right? It's almost like it's not even worth it. And frankly, I don't think people use RAT networks for the discount at all.
Well, but one of the things to remember is all the stuff people complain to us about off of both the major primary networks that, you know, it's a discount off some made-up inflated charge. We have no control of what the charges are. How do they come up with these numbers? For all those reasons, where you understand that you can complain about it, it's like your mother-in-law, right? You complain about her, but there's nothing you can do about it. She's just there. Just stuck with her. I mean, as long as you want to be married, right? I have to deal with that with my wife every day. That's your primary network. But with the wrap, you don't have to do it. They're the same, like Ron just mentioned, meter discounts off those same charges. You have no audit rights. You're limited. Yes, there's no balanced billing, however. And that's why people like it. It's easy. But as John is going to talk about, because he is our expert in regards to really deciphering and looking at these network contracts, he's going to actually share with you real-life provisions that we have seen in the wrap network contracts that are, if anything, maybe almost worse than what you see in the primary network. So, John?
Thanks, Adam. This first one is a great classic example of what always happens with plans and wrap networks. This quote here, client shall adjudicate contracted claims according to the terms of its benefit plan document. Fantastic. That sounds absolutely perfect. My plan document says I'm going to pay this particular claim at, say, 150% of Medicare. Great. Thanks, wrap contract. But wait, there's more. I'm not going to waste your time reading these, but I do hope that you will give them a read either on the slide right now or on the slide deck that was emailed to you this morning. Or, of course, this webinar will be recorded, so feel free to relive this experience. But basically, two paragraphs up from these provisions is where it says you should use the plan document to adjudicate claims. Two paragraphs down, it says, but wait. You can't use your own usual and customary or similar criteria. You can't do any bundling, or you can't use any clinical editing logic. Well, then, what are you really using the plan document for? If you can't use the plan document, but you have to use the plan document, what have you been doing here? I mean, this is just a strange conversation. So I cannot tell you how many calls and emails we have gotten from TPAs and plans and brokers that say, our network contract says we should use the plan document to adjudicate claims. Are we good with this repricing? And we have to say, well, hang on, keep reading the contract. Don't stop there. In two paragraphs, it directly contradicts itself. And the question then is, well, which one do we follow? And our answer is, you know, it's hard to know. But in our experience and based on the industry, it becomes very clear that they don't want you to rely on the plan document's cost containment provisions. They want you to rely on the plan document's coverage provisions, meaning if a service is covered per the plan document, then it's covered per the network contract. But if a service is only covered at 150% per the plan document, well, that's what you have to ignore. How do we know? Where's the line? Well, it's very ambiguous. That's the whole problem. Those two provisions are obviously mutually exclusive. You cannot simultaneously use the plan document's provisions and ignore the plan document's provisions. What's the point of drafting a cost-containing plan if you're not even allowed to use it? Most of these wrap networks, just about all of them, in fact, that we've seen, have the plan forfeit its right to use savings or cost containment. And what that means is that when providers agree to be part of the wrap network, it's on the condition that they can charge their billed charges, whatever those may be, minus the network discount. Yes, they are offering a network discount, but as Ron said before, what's the discount off? It's off something arbitrary and inflated, and again, with Ron's disclaimer, this is not every provider, this is not every network, but when it comes to wrap networks, it's very, very eerily common. I mentioned this before, but the plan document then becomes nothing but just a list of covered services. Next to each one, you mark yes or no. Is dialysis covered? Yes, but it's nope. So you said yes. If dialysis is covered, it's paid at the network rate. If dialysis is covered at 150% of Medicare, it's still paid at the network rate. That is the problem. What the plan says doesn't matter, even though the contract says you have to use the plan.
All right, so you want to hear a funny story? We were looking at a contract which indicated that the payer was not allowed to perform any kind of audit, all right, for bundling, clinical editing, logic, these things, basically to ensure that the claims are being paid in accordance with their plan document, like John just mentioned. And so we went back and basically said, look, this plan has a fiduciary duty to pay claims in accordance with the terms of their plan. They need to perform this audit. So the other side says, all right, no problem, we'll revise our contract. You see the language here. They are now allowed to perform the audit. They're just not allowed to apply the results of the audit. So you could spend the time and resources performing the audit. You just can't do anything with the information you get. And that's not unusual. You may find that when you ask somebody who's issuing one of these contracts, are we allowed to perform audits, they're going to say yes. The real question you need to ask is, are we allowed to actually do something with the results of the audit? I know that's sickening. Let's also talk about the definition of a clean claim, the information that you're actually allowed to receive in the first place. First and foremost, I want to make sure everybody understands the difference between the word or and. And means everything in the list needs to be made available. Or means you can pick and choose any of the items in the list. So when you see language that indicates that a clean claim is a UB or a HICVA or any other form containing information sufficient to pay a claim, do not lock in on the other form containing information sufficient to pay a claim. Because if you're a third-party administrator, plan administrator, and you see that last item, you're thinking, that's wonderful. We can tell them what the plan requires. We can tell them what we need in order to pay the claim. And the clean claim requires that they provide all that information to us. Wrong, because they can say, well, we prefer the HICVA or the UB. It's or, not and. Second, and this is extremely important, the term, any form containing information sufficient to pay a claim. According to whose definition? Who decides? Anytime you have ambiguous language like that and it's not clear who gets to decide what information is sufficient to pay a claim, needed to pay a claim, what someone will do when examining language like this is they will look at the other language surrounding it. The example I could give you is the word Georgia. When I say Georgia, am I talking about the state or am I talking about a woman, right? Well, if I say New York, California, Alabama, Georgia, you know that Georgia is referring to the state because of the other names that came before it.
Unless those are all your ex-girlfriends.
That's true. You know, people lack some creativity. They just throw darts at a map, and that's the name. But if I say, you know, Samantha, Rebecca, Sarah, Georgia, now you know I'm talking about a woman's name. So when I see the words, other form containing information sufficient to pay a claim, and somebody asks, well, is that an exhaustive list of information determined by the plan document or just something that has the patient's name, the code, and what the charge is?
It's the latter because of what came before it, the UE or the HICFA, and that's the only information that's on those types of forms. So again, look at the entirety of the agreement, not just the language that you think supports what you hope it means. So when we go further into the contract, that entire issue is resolved for us, right? I just said that by the fact that the UE and HICFA are sort of the standards listed before that ambiguous other information needed to price a claim. Well, they actually go on to say, a clean claim does not include itemized bills, invoices, or cost data. So, if you thought that itemized bills, invoices, or cost data are other information sufficient to pay a claim, you're wrong, because the contract literally says that that's not included in that previous definition.
Like, the funny thing is stop-loss carriers.
A lot of them will ask for an itemized bill in order to reimburse.
Which is reasonable.
Right. So we're not talking, I mean, I get the whole idea of the invoicing, you know, you have an implant, you know, that's a, you know, you can call FIA, we can get you in. But it's not an easy thing to do. We get that part. But an itemized bill before it's clean? But the funny thing, Ron, and I think you guys are going to touch base on this in a second, you're going to touch base on it. We're talking about a difference of 15 days, regardless if it's clean or not.
That's right. After 30 days, HICFA comes in, UB comes in, right? And you're arguing, well, according to the contract, I need any form containing information sufficient to pay a claim. And this UB lacks the information sufficient to pay a claim. I demand the itemized bill.
So let's say the RAP network and the provider go, okay, Ron, you're right. You're going to get the itemized bill before we can call this a clean claim.
This is not a clean claim.
Well,
guess what? Clean claims are paid within 30 days. Dirty claims are payable within 45 days.
As long as you send something in, like a piece of paper that you ripped off the back of something.
An IOU on the back of a napkin.
And wrote down $50,000, it's payable. But you get that awesome discount.
Now, I'm sure you're shaking your head and you're saying, well, that can't possibly be what they mean when they wrote that language. And maybe you're right. But ultimately, a court of law's responsibility is not to take a time machine back in time and ask, hey, guys, before you write that down, what do you mean by that? No, their job is to look at the four corners of the document, read the language, and tell you what it says. And if you sign a contract that has that type of language, you deserve what you get.
And more importantly, this is what we see across the industry. We're not just citing language because what if or something might happen. No, this is language that is very, very frequently contentious. This happens. This is a real thing. So another provision which is a little bit problematic a lot of the time and actually ties into what we've been talking about is that covered services means healthcare benefits and services which a member is eligible to receive under the terms of the benefit plan. What are you eligible to receive? If your plan pays 150% of Medicare, I would argue that you're eligible to receive 150% of Medicare. This is not rocket science. It's all matters of interpretation. It's all the way you look at things, but the way that payers and TPAs look at things and the way that these RAP networks and their providers look at things are very, very different animals. One of my favorites here is the second quote here. Clients shall, when accessing such networks, compensate network providers in accordance with network provider agreements and using only contract rates. Well, you might ask, what does the network provider agreement say? Well, that's where it gets funny, because you'll never know. They will never, ever tell you. Besides the fact that we have seen them, and for the most part, they're about 90% identical and exactly what you'd expect, the network provider agreements do sometimes have provisions that contradict what's in the payer contract. For instance, the payer contract might say that payment is due within 15 business days. So you pay a claim within, say, 14 business days, and the provider comes back and says, no, 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 that payment was late, because our contract with the network, as the provider, says that payment is due within 15 calendar days, and that expired 3 days ago, therefore you forfeit the discount. As far as the payer knows, the payer has done everything it can possibly do to comply with that contract, but that contract also says, thou shalt abide by the provider contract, which it's never seen, and which says something completely different. The best part is, the kicker, the networks often don't standardize their payer and provider contracts. I've dealt with issues on a number of occasions, probably close to a dozen at this point, and this is just me, not everybody on the legal team, just me personally, where the network says, oh, we didn't realize there was a different payment time frame, but regardless, you have to follow them both. And of course, the only way to follow them both, you've already violated, because your contract said one thing and the other contract that you weren't allowed to see said a completely different thing. It is very, very problematic. The payment time frames and dispute resolution is another thing that can vary between those contracts. You promise that all claims are final and indisputable after 12 months. But the provider's contract says if you're underpaid, you can challenge that payment forever. So the payer's sitting there saying, no, it's been 13 months, it's final. Sorry you didn't realize it sooner, but it's final. And the provider says, well, no, I've got this agreement that says I can do it forever. And who's the network going to side with? 11 times out of 10, we see the network siding with the providers. So the lessons from this are that the SPD governs covered services, but there's more. The contracts are really what govern the covered services. And of course, there's covered amounts for those covered services. And that is where the disputes really start rolling in. Another problem, of course, is that plans never see the network provider agreements. We've seen a handful, but literally only a handful. Even when we do see them, it's usually part of a dispute process, and it's usually the provider or the network highlighting or copying one or two paragraphs that are relevant and sending them to us. For whatever reason, these networks and providers are deathly afraid of disclosing these agreements, even though mostly they're the same, but those provisions that are different, we all know on the payer side, it's completely inequitable to ask someone or really force someone to agree to a contract that that person has never seen. Yet it is the standard practice, it's done every day, and TPAs and plans have no choice but to agree to it or just leave the network entirely. And as Adam mentioned, most plans can't just up and leave a network. It's not realistic for most plans.
Right. So again, that network loyalty isn't an issue when it comes to wraps. But here's one very important thing. Unlike your primary network where you pretty much know that you're not going to do direct contracts with facilities that are in your particular area, we get it. However, with the wrap networks, one of the things that the wrap network contracts say is that you, the client, will eliminate all current wrap and or out-of-area relationships and will utilize this program exclusively. Key thing on two things. One is you will only use that wrap. So you have a national wrap. Let's say that you on your own decided to make 5 direct contracts through some medical tourism work that you have with a particular facility, let's say in Oklahoma City. You have a direct contract there. You have a direct contract with a facility in Orlando because you have a bunch of employees that travel to Disney World for vacation.
Lucky.
What they're right, Ron, you never get to leave the office. What they're basically saying is if you have any contracts at all outside of your primary network, you've got to terminate them all if you want to use the wrap.
Right.
On top of that, the fees are no different than what you're seeing on with cost containment fees. Now, remember, we have cost containment contingency fees. But we actually feel we have to actually work on them. We have to actually work the file, negotiate, make a deal, get signed off, whatever it might be. This is literally somebody running your claim electronically through a database, re-adjudicating it, spitting it out based on a predetermined discount that is no different than a network discount, except if anything, they're less. Here's the reality. You're paying 20 to 35% access or fee off of the savings. Some of the discounts we've seen are as low as 2%. So you're getting a 2% discount for exclusivity. What discount would there be if there was no exclusivity? 1%? So let me give you an example. You have a $100,000 claim. You have a 10% discount on an out-of-network. You're paying $90,000. You're paying 25% on the 10 grand savings. Your actual discount is $7,500. Your discount is 7.5%. These systems are not designed to save money, folks. Anyone that's working with wraps, it's not about saving money. What it's about is, depending on your plan and where you're located in this country, it's somewhere between 5 to 7% of all of your claims. All this is meant to do is to look like a network claim, feel like a network claim. You're processing it no different than a network claim. It's adjudicated the same way as a network claim. It's not being touched by any people, and there is no balance billing for the patient. The patient has no noise.
That's the key.
That's the key. it's not designed to save money. It's designed to look like a normal network claim. That's all it is. Even though the patient has no skin in the game, has no loyalty to the rep, you're trying to make it look and feel. If there's any area in your plan design right now, let's say you are not ready for full RBP, you are not ready to leave your network. You're a union plan and you love Blue Cross or you love Cigna. Okay. If that union member goes out of network, you could have the claims paid in a different way. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to John to talk about some of these quote-unquote modifiers.
Thanks, Adam. We've talked about a number of these already, so I'm just going to kind of breeze through this slide. But basically, these are options for kind of modifying the network, as you can glean from the title. Reference-based pricing can be incredible savings, but it's very hard to do. To have a successful reference-based pricing plan takes a lot of planning, no pun intended. It takes a lot of cooperation between different vendors, and it takes a lot of education for the employee and the employer. And basically, it's not viable for 9 out of 10 plans, if even that many. So the primary network is the backbone for the employees. It's how they can go onto a website, find out which providers are in network, which are out, where they will be charged the least amount of coinsurance, and they're good to go. Contrast that with narrow networks, which I would say make the network smaller. A narrow network is exactly what it sounds like. It is a network that is more narrow than a normal primary network. One of the draws that used to go along with networks was steerage. Providers in the network got steerage from the plans. But nowadays, when there are 20,000 providers in the network, each one of those providers is getting significantly less steerage than it used to. It's sharing the steerage with all the other providers, especially in an area where there are just a ton of providers, like here in Boston. Any one provider is not really reaping any real benefit from being in the network, which is why the discounts are steadily decreasing. To contrast, a narrow network puts fewer providers in the network and splits up all the patient's steerage among that smaller group of providers. Typically, then, the providers are able to offer better discounts, and it's just overall a better value for the plan. Now, the opposite, I would say, of a narrow network is a wrap network, which essentially expands the primary network. If there are 20,000 providers, for example, in the primary network, that primary network with a wrap tacked on, maybe 25,000 providers or even 30,000 providers. Even less steerage, less value. Essentially, wrap networks give you the security of not having balanced billing, but the discounts are typically much less than primary networks, and the value is just not as good. And of course, on the other end of the spectrum, there's just individual claim negotiations. Individual claim negotiations can be enormously beneficial for plans, but it's not practical for literally every claim. For the occasional very, very large claim that's not subject to a discount or maybe subject to a very small discount, absolutely, send the claim to a negotiator. But on a large scale, in a high-volume business, you can't individually negotiate every claim. It's just too time-consuming.
And that's why people purchase wraps.
Exactly. That's the point of a wrap network. It's essentially a replacement for individual claim negotiations. Now, everything I've talked about on this slide has its issues, right? The best is probably a narrow network, but even then, the smaller the network, the more potential there is for out-of-network claims. What's the alternative? Well, for this exact reason, we have developed FIA Unwrapped. And actually, one of the questions that we got a little earlier was, and I quote, "Are you mind readers?" The answer is apparently yes, because we've presented this webinar and developed this service to help you. And we know that most of you are having problems with out-of-network claims. That's why we're here. FIA Unwrapped is, in a nutshell, it's reference-based pricing for out-of-network claim. The plan keeps its primary network. It's Buca or whoever it's using. It keeps the primary network, and then for out-of-network, instead of accessing a wrap network, you do a sort of reference-based pricing approach with our element of balanced billing support on the back end. So what does FIA Unwrapped do for the plan? It reduces costs. Very simply, it reduces costs of the plan. And when the plan's costs go down, as we know, members' costs go down as well. Because it's based on a reference-based pricing chassis, medical trend increases are virtually nullified. 150% of Medicare is not going to double anytime soon.
If you're paying 150% of Medicare, you don't risk that price arbitrarily going up by any decisions made by the provider. Whereas, of course, if you're paying a 10% wrap network discount, if the provider's charges go up, your discount effectively goes down, even if it stays at 10%. Reasonable reimbursement is the key here. And as many of you probably know, maybe you've experimented with it, maybe you've heard about it, maybe you've heard us talk about it, reference-based pricing is all about reasonable reimbursement based on the fair market value. And in our minds, and in fact in the minds of most of the courts who have looked at this, if you're not under contract, the fair market value is what you should be charging to begin with. So when the plan pays something that's closer to the fair market value, it becomes much, much harder for the provider to justify its charges and really argue that the reference-based pricing is not valid. So as I mentioned, FIA Unwrapped encourages you. It doesn't just let you. It encourages you to keep your primary network and get rid of the wrap networks. Everything we've been talking about today points to the fact that wrap networks are just not ideal. You know, it's a good stopgap. It's a good way to contain costs for the time being, but something better has come along, and it's time to really take a good look into the wrap networks and see what is right for you.
A couple key points I want to make on this. So two things. People say, all right, well, how do we do this? Very simple. The key about a wrap network is that you have the data flow, right? It's seamless, okay? The data, if it's an out-of-network claim, it's automatically sent to a different facility, it's sent to a different modifier. The claims are repriced based on the wrap, not the primary. It's very simple from an editing, coding, and IT perspective. Nothing would change in regards to unwrap. The same exact thing happens. If it doesn't hit the primary, the claims are paid based on a repriced amount that is determined and altered in the plan document. Your SPD would get an amendment as to how you pay out-of-network claims. So if you go into your plan doc and you do edit, find, and you find and do a search for out-of-network and how those claims are paid. Right now, 90% of you have language that says based on the usual and customary charges in the area. If that's how you're paying out-of-network claims, then if you go to Orlando Regional Medical Center, you're paying them whatever they charge. And if you see what they charge versus what it costs them to perform the services, you'll realize you're getting ripped off. You change that language to be tied to a Medicare or cost charge ratio, et cetera. Anywhere from 120 to 170% of Medicare, it really depends. We've seen clients go as high as 200% and still save money. But at the end of the day, the data claims feed doesn't change, and your plan language, for the most part, stays the same, except an amendment that would have to be put in place in order to change the way and the amount you're paying for out-of-network claims. So, based on that, I want to go over a couple of examples. I'm going to share with you folks five actual examples. We use five different claims types, five different places across the country. Check out this first one. These are all literally within the last 2 weeks. Bill charge of $184,000 for the implant. The wrap discount available was 15%. Okay, not bad. So therefore, the plan would have to pay $156,000. The stop loss spec was $100,000. The plan paid with sign-off, I want to make sure I say that again, with sign-off, $63,735, saving over $92,000 above what the wrap discount amount would have been. Not off the charges, like a lot of vendors try to do, off the actual savings above and beyond the wrap. So imagine if your fee as the administrator is 10% of the savings. There's $9,000 right there on that one claim. Next claim, knee replacement. We see these all the time. In Manhattan, Kansas, bill charges $106,000. Now, this is where brokers and administrators and experts, supposed experts, get turned on to wraps. 40% discount. Awesome. If I told someone they get a 40% discount, they think that's amazing. Great. Look at what is payable. $64,000. That's what you would have paid if you just stayed with that national wrap we all know. Instead, same amount of work from the TPA standpoint, just change one paragraph in the plan doc. That plan paid with sign-off less than $24,000. Over $40,000 in savings above the wrap. That is a wrap discount of 40%, and we still saved another $40,000 on top of it. Real savings. Next one, my favorite. and John's favorite too.
Oh, yeah.
Air ambulance, San Antonio, Texas, 55,000 in charges. We have seen, on average, 5% is not only the RAP network discount, but that's the primary network discount. Okay? We saw $15,002 in paid claim with sign-off, $38,000 above and beyond the RAP. So this is a perfect example of you got a RAP claim, small discount, coming to do you can. Oh, well, here's the thing. Someone says, well, you know what? Not all my claims are 50 grand. What about those smaller claims? Well, here you go. You got a physician in Fresno, bill charge of $7,500, RAP discount 12%. That means you're paying $6,600 through the RAP. I can't make this up. Paid with sign-off, $582.26. That's $6,000 above and beyond the RAP network discount. Last but not least, my favorite place in the world, Orlando, Florida, my favorite facility. You all know who it is. $220,000 of bill charges for an ER admission, 20% RAP discount, with sign-off, $88,000 payable, savings of $88,000 above and beyond the RAP. Why do I bring this up? Last but not least. If you look at these only five claims, the average TPA has over 10,000 of these claims. That's a mid-sized TPA. Five claims, total bill charges of $574. With the RAP, they would have paid $456. With sign-off, the clients paid $127,000. That's a 70, if you, for those of you that are addicted to discounts, it's a 78% savings of the bill charges, 72% in savings above and beyond the RAP rate. There's no reason in the world to continue to use RAPs based on the technology that's available in the industry today. I can see what we're seeing a lot of people do nowadays is narrow their network. And Ron loves to talk about this. They narrow that network and then tie in an RVP cost plus scenario on the out of network, in essence, making the network larger yet smaller at the same time. So if people need to go to an out of network facility, they have access to fee unwrapped, as an example. One thing that has not been brought up is very simple. One thing that's not been brought up is the fact that there are incentives written into the plan document above and beyond this. This, to me, is college level. If you want to get to graduate level, that is when you start incentivizing your employees to actually look at out-of-network options rather than even the network options because those savings are so big. Now, we're getting something here regarding questions regarding what does sign-off mean. So, and I apologize for those of you who don't know. Yes. Sign-off does mean that the provider has agreed to accept it, the payment in full, and not balance bill. If you go back a couple slides, one slide, this here is real. When you see this from a lot of industry, a lot of so-called companies in the industry that are offering their cost containment services, there is no sign-off. They're putting numbers out there just based on what they decided to pay. But there is no guarantee that the patient won't be balance billed and the providers won't come back 2, 3, 4 years later. These numbers here are based on specifically the fact that there is sign-off from the facility, meaning, i.e., no balance billing of the patient. We're also being asked, do we have out-of-network RVP language already built into our SPD system, in our PDM? The answer to that question is yes. We would not offer this service if we didn't have that language already built in. And for those of you that don't work with our software, you could just have access to this language as an amendment to your offline plan documents as you need. Can the percent of savings fee exceed the negotiated claim? Here's the bottom line, and I didn't even bring this up because I think it wasn't even, didn't even matter, but I guess it does to some people. The fee's 15%. So right now, most of you, because we read your ASAs, are paying 25 to 30% for your RAP network discount, for your RAP network savings. So let's say you have 30% with 20 going to the RAP and 10 going to you. You can continue to have that 30% fee. We get 15, you get 15. It doesn't matter. We don't need to alter anything. The point being is, this is a game changer in our industry. We're seeing a lot of clients save a lot of money. And as Ron likes to say, a lot of this ties into all the normal carve-ups that you see on a daily basis. that now can be looked at as out-of-network instead of utilizing the rest.
Yeah, you know, people have been brave before, and we just need to rinse and repeat. It's funny because throughout this entire presentation, and Adam, you kind of just mentioned it now, when we talk about why are people using RAPs and out-of-network claims, it's because we fear the out-of-network claim. And it's all, I keep hearing in my head the Blue Oyster Cult and Don't Fear the Reaper, I Need More Cowbell. You know the song I'm talking about. Only I'm hearing about unwrapped claims. I'm talking about out-of-network claims. And it's just because people are afraid of the balanced billing. But you have to understand, balanced billing and out-of-network are not synonymous. Out-of-network just means it wasn't pre-negotiated in the form of a contract. But there's a huge space between the two. And what we've done as an industry is everything we can to avoid out-of-network claims as much as possible, even if that means using an expensive, very ineffective RAP network. And when you look at things like, for instance, a dialysis carve-out, if you're not using at least a dialysis carve-out, shame on you. Because what we've done as an industry is identify the Medicare Secondary Payer Act, Medicare Coordination of Benefits, ways to leverage the law and secondary payers to eliminate balance billing. And once we realized that balance billing was no longer a threat, payers were more comfortable carving out dialysis. I'm telling you right now, the same way there are effective methods to avoid balanced billing with a dialysis carve-out, so too there are effective methods to avoid balanced billing with other out-of-network claims. So the same way you should be carving out dialysis, you should be carving out all out-of-network claims. You should not be afraid to have out-of-network claims. And in fact, there are certain instances where you should invite out-of-network claims and deal with them on a case-by-case basis. When we talk about how are you going to deal with them on a case-by-case basis, don't be arbitrary. I mean, I understand when you're listening to us, you're probably thinking, okay, guys, I could beat you. I could use my pocket lint plan. We pay the provider whatever I happen to have in my pocket at the time. Okay, yeah, I get it. Except the thing is, you'll never be able to defend that payment. But if the payment is actually based on defensible data, pricing, cost, cost info, and you also offer other incentives to that provider, things like the steerage that we talked about, things like prompt payment, things like direct electronic payment. There are ways to execute deals, and the fact of the matter is we have succeeded in getting providers to accept very reasonable rates on these out-of-network claims. And what ultimately is the alternative? If you're this provider, right, I'm looking down the barrel of a few alternatives. One, this employer can't afford their plan anymore, and everybody's on the exchange. Two, this employer is going to take more greater efforts to ensure that their employees never come to my facility again and only go in-network. Okay, an empty bed means zero paid. Three, I'm going to end up in some sort of a dispute. I get some sort of ridiculous UNC pricing, and now I have to go after the patient for the rest, and Lord knows I'm never going to get anything from them. The alternatives are more costly for the provider. So they're happy to work out a reasonable deal. Understanding all of the things you can do with out-of-network makes it a lot less scary.
One of the questions that we received is, can the percentage of savings exceed the negotiated claim? Not possible. Here's why. Our fee is based off the savings that you get above and beyond what you already have available. So the point is, that's not realistically possible. But again, these are one-off situations, one-off discussions that we can have. We're not going to spend the time on that during the webinar, but I want to make sure we talk about some general best practices, and John's going to focus on that.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Now, these best practices apply to fee unwrapped, reference-based pricing, carve-outs, basically whatever you're doing. Education is key. It is the most important thing. If everybody involved is not acutely aware of what's going to happen, what has happened, what they need to do, the program is going to have a very, very hard time succeeding. Reference-based pricing is probably the best example of that. When patients don't realize that balanced billing might happen, the vendor who's there to help them take care of it on the back end, if patients receive balanced bills and freak out because they don't know what's going on, they don't expect it, that's when the employer can reasonably expect its reference-based pricing plan to not necessarily fail, but getting negative feedback from members and HR complaints and maybe even complaints to the DOL, that is when programs like this fail miserably.
Education. I can't say it enough. Next is SPD language, EOB language, and ID card language. This is something that the FIA group has been preaching for probably since its inception. Your rights are only as good as your plan language. If your plan language stinks, you don't have the rights you need. It's that simple. Make sure your plan reflects what you're going to do. And then, of course, this next bullet, when you do what the plan document says you're going to do, make sure it's accurate, make sure it's reasonable, make sure it's defensible. If you're using a claims repricer, make sure that they're not using the black box approach, meaning claims go in one side, they come out the other side. If you say, hey, why is it priced this way? They say, because it is. You need to be able to know why claims are priced, how they're priced, and you need to be able to defend it when providers ask that same question. Another thing is patient advocacy. We actually hosted a special hour and a half webinar on this not that many months ago. The DOL has come out with a new FAQ about reference-based pricing and how balance bills need to be treated. If you want to give us a call or an email at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com, we are more than happy to discuss it with you. But bottom line, if patients don't have a choice, they can't be balance billed. Employers have a duty to make sure that patients are protected, period. And lastly, the back-end support, balance billing, and of course there are fiduciary concerns. There are a lot of different notions of what constitutes fiduciaries or fiduciary concerns, but at the end of the day, we're all going to be fiduciaries, and you need to make sure that your duties are covered.
Perfect. Guys, thank you so much for today. We hope you got something out of this. Remember, this is 5 to 7% of all the claims that you process on a daily basis. Our next webinar is September 22nd, 2016 at 1 p.m. Eastern. It will be basically all about legal. We're going to focus on our top 20 questions that we get so far in the year, in 2016, related to everything that has to do with self-funding. So if you want some free legal advice, dial in next month, September 22nd. Hope you have a great rest of your summer, and we'll see you in the fall. Thank you all, and on behalf of Ron, John, Kelly, and myself, thank you and have a great day.